Hey everybody, Jason here. Just wanted to introduce today's show by letting you know that instead of bringing you more content from the IREC conference that we just finished hosting in Gainesville for week four, we are going to save the rest of what we captured until later in the season when I think it will fit better. So today we're going to kick off a new series which we call Disaster Ingredients. And over the next few weeks, we're going to bring some discussions with guests that have come on to Disasters Deconstructed podcast with us to talk about their research and their expertise as it pertains to these ingredients. So in the next few weeks, we have coming up discussions about natural hazards, about vulnerability, about exposure, and about capacity. And today we are beginning this series by talking about natural hazards with Jasmine Scarlett. So thanks for joining us again this week and really hope you enjoy it. I'm Jason Von Medding.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
Welcome to Disasters Deconstructed Podcast.
Let's try that. That'll be a good start to an episode, wouldn't it?
What are you looking at?
I'm looking at a bookshelf. Like, it's an amazing bookshelf.
Why do you like it?
Well, it's kind of similar to mine, I guess. You know, we share sort of 70% of the books. But lack of fiction, Jason, is just unforgivable.
Who reads fiction?
Everybody reads fiction. Come on. Well, you know, one day, you'll realize what you're missing out on.
You recommended some to me before and...
I still haven't read it. I'm going to persist.
You always recommend fiction.
And
I read some of them, but I just can't get into fiction. Sorry. You can keep trying.
Yeah, I'll keep trying. Like, sure. Like, every time I see you, I'm just going to bring you a book of fiction and then I'm going to test you on it.
I get like halfway and give up.
Anyhow, so natural hazards.
Yes. Who are we going to talk to today?
Oh, we've got a really cool guest today. It's Jasmine Scarlett. She's amazing. I mean, well, both of us.
I agree.
We're following her on Twitter. I think she's just great in communicating science in this really simple way and a kind of an open way.
And so, yeah, we thought that Jasmine would be a great person to come on to discuss our topic today. And we're doing a bit of a series looking at the different aspects of or we call ingredients of a disaster. So this is the episode where we're going to talk about natural hazards and hopefully get some tips from Jasmine about how to communicate hazards in a simple way to different audiences.
Right. Yeah.
That's really what we're about, right?
Yes.
Lately, everything's trembling. All my shelters are opening. Feels like everything's crumbling. All the windows are shattering.
Today we've got Jasmine Scarlett with us. Jasmine's research has been looking into sociological impacts of living with volcanoes, and she has been described as a historical and social volcanologist. Jasmine, what does it mean to be a historical or social volcanologist?
Good question. I would say it just means that I look at how people live with volcanoes, but I'm particularly interested in how they lived them in the past and how it informs what's going on at present and maybe into the future.
So what made you get interested in that sort of field?
I found it very interesting through education in school and undergraduate and master's. And then it's also a personal thing because my family's from an active volcanic island and they have stories about the volcanic eruptions and they've told me them and I just like, wow, this is amazing. So it kind of developed from there really, like both with like my personal collection and also with the educational background about them. And they're very pretty things.
So where is your family from? And tell us a bit about these stories from your family.
So my family is, well, part of my family is from the Caribbean island, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, which has the active volcano La Soufriere, which actually was the focus of my master's and PhD research. So I kept it kind of focused on that island. And it's used to be a British colony, so it was my ancestors were enslaved on that island. Mm-hmm. And then after emancipation, they stayed on the island. And through that time, there has been three eruptions. And that was the focus of my PhD research, seeing how the colonial society lived with these eruptions and how they progressed or did not progress in terms of resilience and risk and vulnerability sort of like issues. And stories they have, the main ones they have is the last two ones. So there's an eruption that happened in 1902 to 1903. It went on for 10 months. And there's an eruption in 1979, which was just before they gained independence. Mm. And those are the stories that they know and remember and shared. And for them, it was a very scary experience because St. Vincent is a very tiny Caribbean island with a big volcano on it. So everyone is impacted by an eruption, no matter how big or small it is. So for them, it was very scary and they didn't know what to do because back then there wasn't really much disaster management in place, so they kind of just had to fend for themselves or their thing. And the government response, well, in 1902 was pretty much non-existent. It was very poor. The actual governor of the island was actually on another Caribbean island and giving orders to like two council members that were there at the time or sort of thing. In 1979 it was better, no one died in that eruption, but still it was very disorderly how it was handled.
Your horses, it's too cold to read face expressions that
so mean one of the things that we talk about on the show a lot is the different ways in which people perceive disasters and misunderstand disasters, and it's kind of a core element of our podcast. So one of the things we wanted to ask you was, you know, about this issue where people confuse a natural hazard with a disaster. Obviously you do a lot of science communication and you're prolific on Twitter you have a big following. And so to do that, you need to communicate quite carefully and specifically to different audiences. How do you overcome this problem of people thinking that a hazard and a disaster are the same thing?
Personally, I think I'm still trying to find the correct way of doing that. Mm. But I think I usually start with the gospel, I suppose, that my undergraduate lecturer taught me, because I did my undergraduate in geography and natural hazards. So I learned human and physical geography and disaster management. Okay. And my disaster management lecturers always said that it's not a hazard without the people. So that's kind of how I start to open up the conversation of trying to differentiate between the two. So there I usually start with by giving an example of a hazard that the country where someone is from is impacted by. So if I say, for example, someone's from the UK and they don't know what I'm quite talking about, I say, would you care if a flood happened in the UK? Because that's one of our main natural hazards we suffer from. And then usually they'll say, yes, it would. And of course, we care more about it if it's in a location where they're from or friends or family are from. But then I say, okay, but what about if a flood happened in the Antarctic? Would you care as much? Yeah. And usually they're like, no. So that's usually where that conversation starts. It's like that because we have an attachment to a certain place because of people being there, we are more concerned about it. So that's where I start saying that actually that shows you then that flooding happens wherever you are. So that is a natural hazard process, but it's actually people that turn it into the disaster because we're the ones that are essentially in the way of these hazards. So we're the ones that are being impacted by them. Therefore, that turns it into a disaster because we are involved in that hazard process.
Dip your sadness in this bowl.
do you feel? But it's interesting how, like, sometimes people argue, well, with us and the colleagues about this, you know, that, well, what are we supposed to do as people, you know? Do you want to just kind of move away from anything that may cause a hazard? And volcanoes are very often a common argument when people talk to us about natural, in quotation marks, disasters. So what should we do about it? You know, how do we argue about Pompeii or the impacts of any other kind of historical disasters?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think with volcanoes being put into that category, it's because of how destructive they are and how overwhelmed and insignificant and helpless we feel as people, because we see that with volcanic eruption, they're very much beyond our control. We can't control them in almost no way at all. So it's hard because, of course, we as societies, we're very, you know, we have positive and negative experiences with volcanoes. Like, main positive experience is that it gives us fertile soil so we can produce crops, and that's usually the main attraction to people living near volcanoes. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's not easy for everyone to move away from a volcano because, well, it could be many factors, like they don't have enough money, or they're like refuse to leave because it's where that's the only place they've ever known. So it's hard to, you know, it's hard to think about how you would address it because we're so attached to volcanic landscapes because we've always lived near or on them. So it's hard to move people away because there's no room left, essentially. So we have to try and find ways to live with them and be like, okay, these things are natural, processes are happening, we need to find some ways to reduce them, reduce the disaster impact. So I suppose in a way it's trying to change our perception of how we view them as a disaster, because obviously it's us as people that's causing them to be a disaster, whereas the volcano just the volcano does its thing whenever it wants. So it's just finding, I suppose it's just finding the balance between what can we do as people to live with them whilst the volcanoes do what it wants to.
I guess this what can we do is quite a big argument, isn't it, in disaster risk management, because we see quite a lot of technocratic actions that are aimed at sort of taming nature, which fail pretty much all the time. But somehow policymakers and those with power, they seem to insist that actually we can, we can change the way the river flows, or we can build concrete slabs that would hold the kind of land from sliding. Yeah. Because that's not a healthy way to look at nature either, isn't it?
Yeah. 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 I think with these sort of approaches, it's because people want to be seen as doing something, and usually that involves putting a physical structure in place to show that they are doing something about it. And that's more immediate for people to recognize that, oh yeah, they're actually, you know, they are concerned and they're helping. It's usually not the best approach, but for people who make these decisions, it's a more obvious way to show that, look, I am doing something. Look what I'm doing to help you, sort of thing. So yeah, it's very hard, particularly with volcanic environments, because you can't always put something in the way, because
can't work volcano,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, that would be great, but say it's like really bad.
But I'm sure somebody tried doing it.
I'm sure, someone's probably somewhere thought about this. But yes, tricky, really.
Yeah. Do you think also with these kind of technical solutions, there's an aspect to that where they're just more business friendly and they fit within the agenda of, politicians who often have different lobby groups that have interests in providing these solutions. It's a more business-friendly approach to reducing risk or appearing to reduce risk than addressing social vulnerability.
I would say that's correct. Because, you know, business solutions are more easier to address than these underlying social issues that would take longer than a government's place in office, yeah, 4 to 8 years or whatever to address, because, you know, it takes a very long time to address those issues and to, you know, improve.
So you finished your PhD recently, right?
Oh, almost. My viva is in 2 months' time.
Oh, good luck. Exciting.
Thank you.
Very exciting.
Cool.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about your PhD research.
Okay, yeah. So my PhD was, like I said earlier, it was looking at how the Colonial Society of St. Vincent the Grenadines came to sort of coexist with the volcanic eruptions of La Soufrière. So for this, I took a historical geography approach mixed with anthropology and then volcanology and disaster management. So it was a very interdisciplinary project. Mm. And it was essentially me looking at three eruptions, so 1812, 1902, and 1979, and then just see from the archive records, because my main data set was archives, documents based across the UK, St. Vincent, and in America. And it was just supposed to see how they, the different ways they responded and reacted and like mitigated or rebuilt across like a 168-year period. So it's more of like a holistic view of the three eruptions and seeing how they've progressed or not to come to terms with living in an active volcanic environment. The results were very interesting, particularly for 1812, because that was not really been looked at before. And in terms of a social perspective, it's quite interesting because in St. Vincent, it's acknowledging their slavery past is unwanted and very uncomfortable. So that's the dark heritage that they do not want to address. Mm. So I am going to try and find ways to disseminate this information because it is part of the social history, but also the volcanic history of the volcano. And the results from that one, it was very hard to get a full picture because, of course, the people who were writing these accounts were colonists and the white elite. Mm. So there was a lot of voices missing. So there was no voices of women, children, slaves, any person who was indentured, because there was evidence of indentured servitude from Irish people as well. So there's a lot of voices missing. So the picture of that eruption is incomplete, but I've tried to get as complete as possible. Yeah. But interesting for that one is that they wanted to just try and get back to the status quo because it was sugar monoculture through the plantation. So it was all about just try and get back to what their crop yields were before as soon as possible so it could continue exporting sugar to the British Empire. For 1902, it was more complex story, not just because the volcanic eruption lasted longer and was more deadly. It was also because there was a lot of racism there. Mm-hmm. By this time, the descendants of slaves were now smallhold farmers, but there was a lot of oppression placed on them, so that they did not have the economic, social, or political mobility compared to their white counterparts, particularly of the ones in charge of the plantation states that were still in operation. And it was very hard for them to get help because all of it just basically went to the white population. Mm. And yeah, it was very, for that eruption, it was very hard for me to research them, because obviously it was, you know, this is my family, my ancestors, they were essentially talking about. But it was still very important to highlight that even when a disaster occurs, racism does not end. It still continues, and it's still, and basically with that eruption, it basically split the how people recovered in that society in two. So basically the white population, obviously they could recover way quicker because they got the way more assistance and just way more help, whereas the black population, their recovery was a lot slower because they didn't have the you know, the same amount of help. And what I found really cool for that one is, though, I did actually find my great-grandmother's uncle in the archives. And it was really interesting. So he was Everard Stevens, and he actually wrote to the colonial government to ask for a land, so he can go back to farming as quick as possible. Couldn't find a result of that petition, which is really frustrating. But I just, when I saw that name, was like, that name looks familiar. So I actually called my granddad. I was like, granddad, do you know Everard Stevens? And he was like, yes, that's my uncle. And I was like, no way. In 1979, it was definitely a lot more better because society was more integrated, and basically, as well, because the eruption was actually a magnitude less. So 1812 and 1902 were a VEI 4, whereas 1970 was a VEI 3. So the main impact of that eruption was just ashfall, and the ash was could easily be got rid of, but it was just more of a nuisance and irritant to the population. But so in addition to archives, I actually did interviews for 1979 because it's still in living memory. And when I did ask them what was the, you know, worst bit of the eruption, and most of them said that the ash was everywhere. It was so annoying. So that was interesting. And for that one, the response was a lot quicker, and then there was a lot more assistance from the government. And I think because of the response was quicker and because the eruption was smaller, that's why no one died. And for that one, it was the particular interesting bit is that it happened 6 months before they gained independence. And that is... I don't know if that's a coincidence, but it's something I want to research further.
Your sadness in this bowl, do you feel? So in terms of bringing your findings back to the communities that you were engaging with, what kind of ways would you communicate those findings back?
Yeah, so St. Vincent actually holds a volcano awareness week every year to commemorate the 1979 eruption and to keep, you know, the awareness and the education about the volcano in the minds of the people. So I would, one way to do that would be to collaborate with the organizers of that event, which includes the Seismic Research Center of St. Vincent, of the University of West Indies, because they're the ones who take charge of that, and I have been in communication with them, and they're happy to find ways to include my work into that.
Great.
And also, I try to find simple like methods of disseminating, so like maybe like a comic or a little leaflet or something, just the main findings of it. But also because I did use the archives of St. Vincent, they were like a copy of my thesis. So I'm going to donate a copy of their thesis to their library. So whoever is interested can look it up. And also there's still the indigenous population on the island. So I'm looking to try and give them a copy of the thesis, because I have tried to do my utmost best to include their voices into the narrative of these eruptions, because, you know, it's their islands as well. So I have been speaking to someone to try and find ways of getting a copy to them because it will be expensive, but yeah. I'm hoping to give them a copy as well. So try to find like traditional ways of disseminating information, but also some creative ways as well. Because it's basically like a history project. So I want to try and find interesting ways to share it with them.
Mm.
For sure. Let us know where that goes and if you have anything that you want to discuss down the line, or you do end up doing a comic or anything, we'd be really interested.
Yeah, no problem.
You mentioned like the kind of agenda to get back to the status quo, which is kind of resonates with many historical disasters. And actually it kind of is the agenda of those with power in a society is to return to the status quo as quick as possible, right? And so that's I mean, Naomi Klein talks about the elite panic, you know, rather than the population panicking as Hollywood kind of would have you believe.
Yeah.
It's actually those with power that panic because the status quo is disrupted, right? So I thought that was interesting that you mentioned, even in your research historically, that has gone back hundreds of years, you know, this elite panic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can say all the things that made your stomach turn today.
I was going to ask lastly about your research. Do you find any specific challenges that you would like to kind of share about with researching natural hazards in particular, and with regards especially to kind of communicating with people, maybe some of the perceptions people have about natural hazards that you need to try to correct or re-educate through your research? Is there anything that you've kind of picked up in your work so far?
I would say the main challenge I picked up on is trying to find the simplest but most informative way of sharing your findings. Mm. Because disasters are very complex, so how to find the best way of sharing all that complexity in a space of a talk or like an elevator pitch speech. Yeah. It's quite hard to do. And like, I know I like talked about my research, but there are so many other things I found in it. And it's like, which is the bits that are most important and most relevant to people. And yeah, I suppose that's one thing. And I'm still trying to figure that out. Yeah.
I suppose it depends who you're talking to as well. It's what's relevant to which audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I would say obviously the main thing is that racism doesn't cease once a disaster happens. Mm. It still happens, and it actually does really affect how people recover, or even who lives or dies in some situations.
Yeah.
So I think that's very important. And for that, I actually did parallels with studies in the present, just to show that, you know, ongoing, this has been happening for years and years and years, but again, it's whether it's comfortable enough to be talking about that, because you know, it's definitely an issue that people in the Western world do kind of sideline, even though it's essentially talking about marginalization in a disaster event. And obviously marginalization is very important, needs to be said, and you know, needs to be talked about.
I just want to pick up on the point about marginalization and sort of perception of disasters. So do you think people actually connect natural hazards with inequality, marginalization, you know, and kind of all the social issues that turn hazards into disasters?
Well, us as researchers, we do, but the average person, I think, doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think about these things. They just think about if it impacts them or not, and they don't think about the different ways it can. And I suppose that's just, you know, I think it's definitely on us researchers to know this sort of stuff, but to communicate that to the person who is not, who doesn't research natural hazards or disasters, I think that's okay if they don't know that. Of course, when we come to communicating risk, then we might have to pick up on these things and we might have to share that information with them to get them to think about it. Because in that way, they could actually maybe find their own ways to reduce their vulnerability and therefore their risk, and then to find ways to increase their resilience. But I think overall, I think it's okay if they don't know these things, because that's kind of our job to do that.
It's true, and I'm just thinking about some of the stuff that Ksenia and I have been working on in terms of looking at why do people not connect disasters with kind of vulnerability and with the social, like we talk about the social construction of risk, right? But most people wouldn't know what you're talking about if you say that sentence. And so we have this paper coming out in the GAR, a technical paper for GAR 2019. And we're sort of looking
nice
at...
Nice plug there.
You like that? I thought it was so subtle. Seriously, look up the paper. No. But anyway, we're basically looking at NGOs and INGOs and the way that they write about risk. And more often than not, it's kind of devoid of any discussion of inequality and power and marginalization. Our findings are arguing that there's a lot of agendas at play, and a lot of people have something to lose if we start to discuss those difficult inequalities and injustices in society. So there's vested interests that want people to believe that disasters are just things that happen and we can't do much about, except maybe invest in some physical protection measures. And I think, yes, people are naive sometimes or ignorant about these things. And it is our job to educate using our findings and kind of communicating science. But at the same time, we're working against a lot of interests which want people to believe that disasters are pretty natural, you know?
Yeah.
So there's my story for the day, my rant. Well, it's been fun, Jasmine.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming
on. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Disasters Deconstructed is available wherever you get your podcast. Out on Mondays. For the rest of season one, follow us and tweet us at DisastersDecon. Really excited to see so many people following on Twitter already. And we're also on Instagram at DisastersDecon.
You've been listening to Disasters Deconstructed podcast. I am Jasmine Scarlett. Have a great day.